Hello, everybody. Welcome to my home. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I'd like to talk about a couple things. Just a couple interesting little tidbits that have been cycling through my little neural cortex. Life's such a trip. It really is. There's a lot of weird things that end up happening in the ins and outs that we do during this intricate dance while we keep our head and our balance like a tightrope. So I had this interesting experience this weekend. My father's going out of town to work again. He works incredibly long hours. He gets paid well, very well. He has a good home, and his family is well taken care of, but he has to work very hard for it. And part of that is going out for extended periods of time, months, weeks. And he's always done this kind of work. It's highly respectable, but it's a kind of work that I don't think that I could see myself being able to withstand or do. I couldn't be away from my creature comforts and my family like that. But a lot of people do this kind of work, and a lot of family people do this kind of work, and people make it work. So he calls me in the noontime, around 11:30-ish, and basically he invites me and my son to go to the zoo with him. And I had a pretty negative reaction, in all honesty, where I got really stressed because I knew I was halfway through some of the things that I was working on that day, and I didn't, subconsciously, I didn't want to change gears, and this was a good thing. Anyways, I'm getting ahead of myself. So I had a cranky attitude, and, you know, he's like, okay, I'll call you back. And I called him back 10 minutes later, and I was like, hey, you know, I'm sorry, I had a bad attitude, I want to go, this is a good idea. You know, I was aware that he was leaving, so I knew that I wanted to spend time with him anyways. And this was an excellent opportunity to go spend time with him and my sisters, with my son, you know, and go have fun. So I was like, yeah, you know, I'm sorry about my reaction on being a baby. Let's do this. So we get to the zoo, and unfortunately, I guess you have to order ahead of time the tickets now. And so this crumbled my dad pretty hard, because he takes a lot of weight onto his shoulders, like the Atlas that he is, in order to make sure that the kids especially are well taken care of. You know, my dad raised me by himself, the same way that I'm raising my son by myself. And there's a lot of cyclical consistency happening here where I can relate a lot, and I hope that he can see how history is repeating itself. So he crumbles under this, though, and you could see it in his eyes where he's like, oh man, this is what I wanted to do. You know, and Odin got sad, and then I had to talk him up real quick and make sure that he understood that we could go again on another day, and that this wasn't a super huge deal, you know. But it's rough. It's always rough, you know. But me, I was like, you know, it's not about whatever we're doing. The most important thing was that I wanted to spend personal time with my dad on this day. And we still had that opportunity to do that. And we ended up going to, like, a Target, you know, and, like, we got lunch and we went to a Target, you know, and that's fine. That's totally okay, you know, because the whole time we were together, and that's the most important part about personal time and family time, even if you ain't doing nothing, you know. And I found that time incredibly valuable, even though he said sorry about 100 times. You know, there was no guilt to be had. And neither me nor my sisters, I think, felt any of that, and Odin forgot about it immediately. So it was a good situation to look at, and I'm still digging it apart. And I've had a lot of really weird mind states lately, you know. And I've been contemplating the differences between a quiet and a bored mind. And I'm fighting against this concept of boredom a lot lately, especially with my child. I don't want him to think that there's a concept of boredom and this idea that we can be bored, like it's this feeling or this setting that's placed upon you, like that we choose to give out that energy of bored. I'm a bored person. It's not like the situation is ever boring. And, you know, and I totally learned that wrong, and I misrepresented how life it was for myself, certainly during childhood before self-control, and then still in my adulthood now. So a lot recently, through I've been working a lot on my meditation and a lot of my on my routines and how I live my days and my energy levels. And I've been noticing that I've been getting real low on my energy levels, which is good, you know, but I'm misunderstanding these low energy levels for myself as being bored, I think. And so that leads me to this aggravation, to this restlessness, where in an effort not to feel bored, which is me just being a boring person because I'm being quiet. No, not even that. It's my mind is starting to settle, especially during my good points in my routines, and so it's getting quieter. And because I'm feeling bored, I'm trying to stimulate it out of it. And by stimulating my brain, by getting aggressive, you know, by snapping at people, snapping at the job, snapping at my child, you know, these are all effects to stimulate myself out of that quietness, which I've worked really hard to build that quiet station. So it's kind of funny that I'm fighting it like that. It's definitely not effective. Anyways, I'm gonna keep thinking about it. I had a good dalliance this weekend with the cap and stem of the magical variety. I didn't chew them very well. It was a very low, slow burn. Very physical. Very physical experience. I watched a couple movies. I watched Paper Tigers, which was really good. It's on Netflix. It's about three dudes who were old, like martial arts students, and then like they come back when they're older because their master dies and they have to go figure shit out. And it's pretty good. I thought it was funny. You know, I've been doing martial arts recently, so it was relative to me. And then I watched this really good movie called Count Me In, and there's this beautiful girl in that movie. It's all about drummers. It's all about like, and so she's part of this like rock band, and she kills it. And I was just stunned during my experience because I was just like, somebody that pretty can make such beautiful music. I was just being silly, but you know, it was a good touchdown. I always consider it a communion, and I'll never forget that giggle. All right. Well, anyways, today we're gonna be getting into the meat of the matter. I got a couple of things I want to talk about. And we're going to talk around them, I guess. So I want to talk about the different types of work in our society. And I want to preface it by saying that if you're listening from another country by chance, you know, like, this is very ethnocentric, and I'm speaking from my viewpoint and the types of work that I see in a settlement like my larger city that I live in. You know, and then I assume that most largest cities around my country operate very similarly, and that there's probably other places that operate very similarly to the United States that do the same thing. So, yeah, I might misrepresent what you experience, but I'm just talking from my viewpoint. So the different degrees, like, I like to picture scales in my head for lots of different concepts, like, because black and white is boring, so the shades of gray minus the egregious sexuality. You know, like, I always like to imagine these sort of degrees for many situations. So the types of work, you know, there's different types that you could fall across this. The first little grouping that I'd like to think about is, you know, like, are you working by yourself or are you working in a group? You know, and from my situation being a cook, you know, I've worked lines with big lines with lots of people. I've worked in huge kitchen with lots of cooks all doing their own thing. And personally, right now, I work by myself, like, completely. You know, I run a little kitchen for a daycare, and I do all the cleaning, I do all the ordering, I do all the prep, I do all the menuing, I do everything, like, all the reorganization, all the fixing. You know, it's a one-man job that I'm doing. And I want to get to the point where I see myself in a food truck, you know? So I see this big difference, and there's big groups and small groups, but, you know, it's always... It's definitely a category for a type of work. And then, is this job a high esteem or a low esteem job? You know, and I was sort of confused by whether an esteem by how well a job is respected, you know, because this is what I'm kind of thinking about. The esteem is the respectability of a job, is how much are you respected? Like, and does that strictly mirror the importance of the job? Importance of the job? I'm not sure. I don't think how respectable a job is how important it is. A lot of people want to be basketball players, but it's really not structurally completely, you know, making society work. It's not any sort of important part. And just to beat a dead horse, you know, but for instance, I can't think of anything right now. I'm sorry. All right. Anyway, we're going to move on. So blue versus white collar. I was interested in this because I never really looked into the history of what these things meant. And so according to Investopedia, the blue-collar worker was first pegged in 1924, and it was often used to describe people of low-income jobs who wore darker clothes to hide the dirt, such as denim, you know, like darker clothing, gray clothing that was harder to read the dirt on, you know. I kind of think like a painter with, you know, dumpy clothes. You know, I guess that wouldn't be a blue-collar. It'd be more of a rainbow collar, but it still applies. So... Man, so I guess like, and so in the 1930s, this guy named Upton Sinclair, who it kind of rings a bell. I feel like he's like a hotel person. Maybe I'm wrong. But he used white collar workers to describe administrative or managerial staff. So that's where we start. And I always kind of think of like the suit with the white collars and like, it makes sense. Especially when you think about nowadays and people in like banking or in... those sky rises in New York, you know, I keep thinking of TV versions of references for this shit, but, you know, like, people who do not get their hands dirty are considered white collar. So, then the last one that I have never heard is pink collar. I don't think this is used anymore. It's for the service industry. It was very derogatory because it was usually female staff that were doing these kind of things. Nowadays, it's a lot more mixed bag. We're talking about serving, waiting, hosting, and it's about half and half nowadays. Where females, it's half and half, man. Like at most kitchens that I've worked at, the serving staff is getting very neutral when it's done right. And when you have a staff that's all female, and like, because I feel like that was the old way that things were used to run in a kitchen, was where the male staff would be all the cooks, you know, the dirty old cooks cracking shitty jokes. And then I've worked in places like that, and then all the female staff are the waiters. And I don't think that's healthy, and I don't think that's good. I think you should always have, like, two bosses on stand on those big-ass kitchens, and one should be a man, one should be a woman. I think that's a good idea. And then, like, try to have a very neutral organization of staff, because it gets kind of funky when you do that half-and-half shit. It's, like, weird segregation, sexual apartheid kitchen bullshit. Whatever you work at, if you're in manufacturing lines, I feel like a lot of these kind of jobs are very similar. So, blue and white collar really comes down to, it's kind of related to the esteem, the respectability, but it also has to come down to geographical location, like rural versus city living. You know, city man, he's born with a golden cane. You know, he walks down across the street and he never has to do shit, you know, or maybe you're handed the money, you're paid into school. Oh, Johnny, where do you want to go to school? I think I'll be a doctor. Oh, you get to choose to be a doctor? Good for you. You know, it's like, depending on where you are, if you're in a rural society that has 500 people, how often do you think you have old money laying around given to you? So rural societies typically are going to have more of these type of jobs. So depending on where you're located, you know, and my city is pretty big, not rural, not skyscraper either, and then there's a lot more stuff up north that's more farming, more cattle and that kind of stuff, especially northern Colorado, up near Greeley, up near the border, you know, like, and so those are a lot more rural zones versus Denver, which is definitely getting techie, you know, and I would consider tech jobs like this new brand of white collar workers with a little bit more self-control. Not self-control, a little bit more self-actualizing ability to choose their path. Like tech guys don't have to be, you know, cubicle workers, even though some of them might be. So just depending on where you're born or what family you're born to could put you into this class of blue or white collar, or at least make it more likely that that's going to be the job that you're going into, you know? So the next tier is going to be pay, high pay and low pay. You know, how much is the job paid for? And I know we discussed basketball a little bit earlier. Not a very important job. Why the fuck do these people have millions of dollars? You know, like, how do sponsorships make so much ridiculous amounts of money versus a farmer? You know, a farmer who's struggling and subsidizing his corn or her corn, you know, like, that's one of the most important jobs that feeds the fucking country, yet we don't pay them as much as a basketball player. Like, this has always been just, it's super confusing to me. Even when I was younger, it just didn't make sense, because I was like, wow, why don't we pay these people more, you know? So between esteem and pay, you know, let's consider some of these situations. Firefighters often was a volunteer situation where people didn't even get paid. I would say high esteem. I think most people think firefighters are badass. Kids adore them. We see movies about them. We write books. It's a very noble, heroic job, and a lot of them don't get paid shit. Teachers, very important job. I mean, fucking literacy, teaching people how to think for themselves and to have brains and to go find new knowledge and to consume and create. You know, this is the future, is our ability to teach our kids, and we pay them dick shit. Yeah, literally shits that come out of penal holes. I know that gross fucking mental image, but maybe that will cause a reaction where you can see how bad it is that our teachers are begging for scraps and paper because they can't afford the paper for their classes. Fuck that. You know, these people need to be paid 10 times as much tomorrow, just for starters. You know, redistribute some corporate fucking taxes from these CEOs and these fucking basketball people to the teachers. You know, if we took $1 million and threw it into, you know, one county, and you had, like, I know there's thousands of counties. I know I'm getting all heated, and but it just seems silly to me. You know, the children are so fucking important. Like, so, all right. So deep sea fishers, I thought this was kind of weird. I think they get paid really well. I know some people, it's like a niche thing where some people who watch them on TV respect them, but unless you've seen it on TV, I don't know if they had that much esteem. So that's why I was kind of considering those ones. And paramedics. Paramedics don't get paid shit either. Often the EMT companies aren't even attached to the hospitals. These are private companies and private organizations that are ferrying people. So that's a big reason why they pay so much, or ask to be paid so much and have such high costs, is because they are private companies that need it. Like they have such high operating costs with all this equipment that they need to ask for that much money because they're not being treated like an essential service, which is ridiculous. You know, like what if it, like in my mind, I always thought that the EMT services and these ambulances were completely attached to the hospitals. And so when I called the hospital and an ambulance came, it was coming from the hospital, but that's not the case. You know, there's hundreds of different ambulance companies across the country that all independently source and help these hospitals. And that's why there's so much fucking variance. I mean, it's actually kind of weird when you start to think about it. You know, so these are some of these like esteem and pay situations that are kind of topsy-turvy and seem kind of backwards to me. When it comes to pay, I thought you guys might be interested just in hearing what the internet had to say about what the highest paid jobs and what the lowest paid jobs are in the country right now. And I didn't go 1, 2, 3. I didn't go to the top three. I chose from the top like 30, I think. So the top 20 highest paying job positions in the country are all doctor positions and all surgeon positions and all like specialist positions. Like they were all medical, which I'm not going to argue saying that medical is not that important. You know, I'm way too fucking squeamish. But if I could pull bullets out of people and reorganize your intestines without vomiting inside your gut cavity while I did it, and get paid fucking amazing, I would do it. But unfortunately, I can't stand even watching somebody else get a fucking shot. Like literally when my son gets his shots, it makes me kind of lightheaded. Like, I'm so squeamish with it, you know, and it's a lot of work, man. Like when you really look at all the schooling, but to be fair, you're playing with people's lives. So it should be a lot of fucking work. You know, I get it. I get why people are paid so much. So the highest paid doctor position was cardiologist, and they're paid $351,827. So the second position, which is 20 down, is a vice president of companies maybe it's not companies. When I was reading it, it just said vice president. So it might be like the vice president, but I assumed it was like the vice president of a company or something. But they get $151,000, So they get that much money. And then a software architect, which I assume is somebody who makes like websites, they get paid $139,127. So yeah, big money. Go make websites, go be a technician, go be an architect, go be a sales rep who makes really good fucking commissions, go be a doctor, go be a business person. But yet again, you know, like schooling, time, effort, you might bankrupt yourself getting into those positions in the first place, or Daddy Trump might have just given you your shit and you might have just walked into the presidency because of it, you know, because of old money. You know, a lot of these people are old money. Think of the Kennedys. They're fucking gross, you know. So lowest paid positions, this was fun for me. So the first one put out was cooks. Cooks are one of the lowest paid people in the entire country, which blows my mind. You know, I control the health of your colon or your kids' colons, at least, you know, like it's such a huge, huge industry, this hospitality industry. The hospitality industry is kind of the segment that is considered restaurants and hotels. So I'm not hotel, I'm restaurant. So it's a huge multi-billion dollar industry in our country alone. My country, not our, sorry to assume, but you know, so the hospitality industry, then tourism is probably like 30-40% of most places' income. That's just the revolving tornado of money just going in and out, pay for this shit, and then it goes back into the economy and goes into other things, and assumably, if it's supposed to be working right. But, so, it's just a huge fucking industry, and we take care of people, and there's so much effort done by good cooks and good staff and good wait staff that really pay attention to people why are we paid dick shit? Like, really? Like, $24,300, which is literally like one-fifth of the amount of a cardiologist. To be fair, cardiologists have a lot more involvement in your health when they're poking your heart than I do when I'm poking your burger. But still, you know, like maybe just double that, 50 grand. You know, like if 50 grand, that's a private chef, like somebody who goes to school for culinary, who is like, you know, a celebrity chef or whatever. Not celebrity, celebrity, like the big names. They probably make really big money from their sponsorships and their TVs and all that stuff. But like, you know, Joe Schmo, private chef, who's working for a rich guy, usually makes about 50 grand, which is still bullshit. You know, like that's what a lot of these, like what I was dreaming. Like in my head, I thought if I was making a private chef, I thought I was going to make it what the VP, the vice president was fucking making. You know, like service industry as a whole and hospitality industry as a whole, looking at this pandemic and how people, like, I didn't take 2 days off work this entire fucking time, and neither did anybody else in my industry unless they got sick with it. You know, like, talk about essential services. Everybody has to eat. Everybody has to be taken care of. Everybody needs fucking compassion given to them in their life when they go buy something stupid in their materialistic world. You know, like, maybe pay service industry people who have to be with people and be humanitarian, maybe give them a little bit more love financially so that they're not struggling and scraping by in their fucking lives. So dishwashers were above cooks and supposedly make $25,600. To be fair, I was a dishwasher and I do make better money now than when I was a dishwasher. But I make probably about 25 grand a year. I'm right about on that cook money, you know. And when I was with a dishwasher, when I was dishing, I was making probably 16, 17 grand, you know. And the minimum's gone up in Colorado, you know. So laundry workers make $26,600. And all of this came from balancedcareers.com, whereas my high pay numbers came from indeed.com. But still, like, I don't know. I don't know which ones I was more shocked by, the high pay or the low pay, because I kind of expected what I saw at the high pay, but the low pay kind of shook me. Because it hit close to home, I think. It's definitely part of it. So my last little bend on these little types of work before we try to wrap it all together and think about what it means is the conformity of the job. Are you conforming in your position or are you a non-conformist? To conform means to play along with the group narrative. Every group, every society has norms. A norm is like a rule, but it's a norm can be an unspoken rule. So laws are norms. But not all norms are laws, and there's a lot of things that people don't even talk about. One of my favorite norms to play around with in my country is that we drive on the right side of the road. You ever noticed that in a hallway, like in a busy university, especially, we treat our feet like wheels? And it's really common to see people veer to the right side. And so, like, if you're going up a staircase especially, you go walk up the left side of a staircase, you'll get mean fucking glares from people. And they might not even say anything about it, or they might call you stupid, you know? But they might not even be realizing why they're mad. They're just like, what the fuck? What is going on in my reality? This guy's in my fucking way. You know, like, but walking up the left side of the staircase, walking the left side of the hall, it weirds people the fuck out in a grocery store, you know? Like, walk on the left side and just stay there, you know? Like, it's, maybe that one's not the best example. So when we conform to society, we're playing along, and some people do it subconsciously, and some people do it because they're scared. Not in a judgmental way, but as in, you know, if you break society's confirmations, like if you do just always walk on the left side, you might bump into somebody because they might be on their phone. They might not even be fucking paying attention because they trust the rules and they trust the norms so much that they're not even looking out for your ass breaking norms. You know, and that could be an analogy for a lot of different situations, man. You know, so to be a nonconformist, the ultimate bend of this kind of work would be crime, you know, to not restrict oneself to the paycheck and the ruled way to get your money, and to never, like, I've known some people who never get jobs, who always do some sort of hustle or some sort of bullshit, and not all of it's criminal. You know, I knew this guy who gets weird snacks, gets them for people, packages them, and then gets it, and then puts them in the box and sends them to people, and then pays them for that service, and he gets paid for that service. You know, and arguably entrepreneurial, yes, he's working for himself. Yes, is that a job? Yes. It's also a hustle, for sure. You know, like, and other types of crime, you know, like there's even blue collar and white collar crime, if you really want to break it down. You know, like on the low scale, the low pay side of crime, you know, like B&Es, like breaking and entering, or holdups, you know, stealing from people at their place of business with, like, you know, armed robbery, you know, or bank thief would be a lot more money. But like an armed robbery of, like, say, a 7-Eleven by some low income people, you know, of indiscriminate color, you know, we're not being racist on this show, you know, but so low esteem, low capital, you know, go in jacket, you might get a couple hundred bucks, high fucking risk, you know, low payout, low esteem, high fucking risk. Somebody gets for an armed robbery, or God help us if, or nature help us if they fucking shoot a person, you know, and take somebody out in that murder, you know, jail time, quite a while, you know, high payout, millions of dollars, white collar crime, you know, like insurance fraud, embezzlement, all this kind of crap, fucking high payout. Some of these people go to nice fancy prisons for like a year or two when they get caught for stealing millions of dollars from people, or say like fucking pyramid schemes, like the Bernie Madoff character, you know, like, so they're even within non-conformed crime, even within this anti-work, there seems to be this variance between white and blue collar. Again, I see, you know, and then there's, you know, drug dealing, you know, and then there's a lot of money in that, which is kind of like a weird place to be, you know, like drug dealers happen to be stepping out of economy. They're stepping out of the main economy too. They're in this black market, which is the prime reason that what they're doing is so illegal, is because they are outside of the economy, which makes them an enemy to the money. It makes them an enemy to the state too, you know, and I don't believe in that war on drug bullshit. I think every human being should have the solidarity to fuck with their mind however they wish. And even if they're hurting themselves, we don't really put people in jail often for cutting themselves, you know, like maybe I'm going to get some angry email, you know, maybe somebody does end up in a mental hospital, but we're not punishing people the way we punish people for possession of narcotics, the way we punish mental illness. So I don't know. If a person's willing to hurt themselves, that's a mental health situation, and that's a separate situation that should be outside of the penitentiary and outside of the justice environment. That's just how I feel. So when it comes down to crime, who's the biggest person getting hurt? The dollar, the banks, because they're outside of the economy. At least that's how I see it. So I hope that gives you some things to think about. You know, like, not all work is the same. You're not everybody feels the way you do, because not everybody's in the exact same type of work as you do. And maybe you can look back at your own work history and see all the different types of jobs you had and see what makes you happier, because not all work's the same. You know, me investigating this and me looking at all the different idiosyncrasies that I could find within my past and my job past, you know, this is me just trying to figure out what worked for me, you know, and what I found that worked for me the most is that I like to work solitary. I don't like to work in large groups, especially, or to be dependent upon people. I do not care about esteem. I work in a very low esteem job, though I think it should be more important, or it should be considered more esteemed because it is important, to be fair. You know, I like blue collar over white collar work. I could not imagine being a sales representative or working in a cubicle or being an office worker. I would lose my fucking mind. I couldn't do it. Don't care about pay. I wouldn't mind being paid a little bit more to be a little bit more comfortable, but I don't need $351,000. I would never work that hard to get that much money. If I could make double, if I could, like I said, that 50K, if I made 50K a year, I'd be a pretty happy gingerbread man. I swear. And conformed or non-conformed? Hey, I'm conforming on record. I conform, you know, but I'm also a dad. If I was a free man, who knows what if I could get away with packaging goods, not drugs, and being able to sell snacks to people, I would do it. But mainly, I think I want a food truck. I just want to work by myself. That's important to me too, is who pays you? Who's your boss? Are you your own boss? You know, who's your employee? Are you your own employee? Are you your own boss and your own employee at the same time? You know, that's an interesting concept that makes me very happy. And the less I depend upon others, the happier I am, because when I get mad and when I fuck up, the only person that I know that fucked up is me. And that is a lot easier to handle than me attempting to worry about the fuck-ups of other people. Or maybe not their fuck-ups even, or my interpretations, just because being with people over time, you get aggravated and you end up blowing up at them. And that's going to happen inside a work family too. All right. I want to go through little bit of spirituality and philosophy, mainly Eastern philosophy this time. I've been reading another Ram Dass book, which I will go into more depth and do some sort of synopsis about, maybe do some more quotes in the future. But tonight I quickly just want to go through four little ideas that I've been ruminating on. And I want to try to tell them in a entertaining way. So the first analogy that stuck out to me from this book was this idea of friction, which basically, if you're constantly working with your desire and never fighting yourself, if you're always giving in, when that part of you goes, hey, I want that chocolate chip cookie, or I want that ice cream, or I want to drink that bottle of whiskey even though I got work in the morning, you know, that's desire. You know, I should just watch more TV and not sleep because I don't need it, or whatever. The way that we persuade ourselves to make poor choices, you know, when we constantly give in to that childish part of our being. And I'm talking about myself. I'm trying to call you a child. You're not a child. You're a full grown man or woman. But there's a childish part of me that does not care how healthy I am or the choices that I make, and is apt to push me into a not very good corner if I don't pay attention to it very well. And that childish part of me is what I would like to label as desire, you know? And so Ram Dass says in his book, and I think it's not even him, I think it was a quotation from another person, but he basically said that if we don't fight our desire, there's no friction. So there's no heat. You know, think of the Indian stick spinning against that little wooden crevice and you're trying to start a fire. You know, that friction, you know. Speaking of fire. But without that friction, we have no heat in our inner core, in our para-atma. Without any friction, we don't have any gip. So basically, if we fight our desires, we apply friction. We apply sandpaper to the inside of our being and to our goals and to our intentions. And this sandpaper creates heat. So the more we fight our friction, the more we fight our desire, the more heat we have inside, the more vitality, and the more power we have, and the more forceful we are as human beings, as fellows in this epic trip that is life. Another really pretty just picture he painted with his words was the idea of growing isn't an immediate stance. It's not a bubble popping. It's not a day of reading and then snap, you know what you're doing. It's not one fuck up and crying about it and promising yourself that you're going to do better and expecting to be all good the next day. Life's not like that. He compared it to our growing and to wanting to be better as the unfolding of a flower. And if you've ever watched a flower unfurl in slow motion, please go watch. Just Google it. YouTube that. There's another really cool Moving Art on Netflix. Has a really good flower episode where you get to see the flowers unfurl. And it's just flowers dancing for 30 minutes. And I watched it like 100 times. But when a flower unfurls, some of them have quite a complex array of petals, really. And as they unfurl, it's a dance, but it's one, two, that they all come out in a pattern, but it's a slow process. Consider the caterpillar. You know, Doss is talking about the caterpillar, and he's like, you know, the caterpillar is not like walking around like, I wonder what it's going to be like when I'm a butterfly. You know, he's just caterpillaring. He doesn't know what it's like to be a butterfly until that chrysalis breaks. You know, it's not while he's in the chrysalis that he knows what it is like to be a butterfly. But at that point, he's no longer a caterpillar either. So the process of growth is slow. It's redundant. And a lot of the times it feels like you're reading the same shit over again. And maybe that's okay. Maybe rereading the passage is what was necessary in order to get the point. And maybe fucking up a couple times is just a synonymous to reading that passage 6, 7, 8 times just because it was hard to understand. And that's okay. We have to have a little bit of compassion with ourselves and love ourselves so that we can unfurl and we can be flowers. Not to Bob Ross this shit. We're going to paint pretty flowers over here. We're going to paint this fucking white cloud. You see that white cloud, guys? That cloud's so pretty. We're gonna paint some nice, pretty yellow dandelions. Okay, I'm not as good as Bob Ross, but we have to have compassion with our process, and we have to be willing to take years to get better. And maybe it's a perpetual process, and maybe we'll spend every single day walking on these beaches, walking on these sidewalks, walking on these wood or carpeted floorings. Maybe we're going to spend all of those steps bettering ourselves, unfurling in a lotus of infinite potential. He also mentions another thing. He calls love contagious, which I like. I think curiosity is contagious too. By modeling what we want to see in the world, we can surprise ourselves. And you start to notice other people bettering themselves too, and that's a beautiful thing. So remember that by loving and by being curious, you're contagious. So it might rub off. Doss, in another separate book that I read several months back, it was called The Only Dance There Is. In one of his speeches, he talks about this really good point that I liked. He says that the idea of knowing, which this is going to go back to the Wittgenstein episode, Wiggin' Out, episode 14. It's got a monkey for the template. But I think Wittgenstein and Doss would agree on this notion, where Doss says that knowing, in big square quotes, knowing is a faith. To know anything, whether science or religious value or philosophical or theosophic, all of these knowings are separate examples of faith. And that when we're claiming to know anything, we're claiming to have experimented with something. And that being the experimenter, there's always a distance between the experimenter and the experiment. And it's sometimes hard to conceive and to even perceive how the experimenter is affecting the experiment, even from the outside. And to be the experimenter doing the experiment, it's very unlikely to witness oneself affecting one's own experiment. So when we're performing all these experiments and learning all of our little bits of facts and making up our knowings and creating our little faith tree of belief in our world, how often do we question and see the distance between ourselves and our experiments? Hopefully, enough. Tonight, we're going to end on the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths are the heart of Siddhartha's philosophy. Siddhartha Gautama is the Buddha. And these truths are what, these four simple ideas is basically the crux of what the whole philosophy of Buddhism is. So if you want to look into Buddhism and know more about what this ideology, what this religion in some aspects is, it's a religion without a god. It's a religion of self empowerment, self-betterment, self-growth, and all the things that I talk about a lot, the contagion of self-empowerment. It's just as contagious as love. When you're working on yourself, other people want to work on themselves too. So the first noble truth, number one, life will always contain suffering. And suffering in Sanskrit was called dukkha. This means that all life is suffering. All life has to die. Everything comes to an end. Everything is impermanent. Because everything is impermanent, you know, everything is very flighty, you know? But that's not why we suffer. Impermanence in itself, the fact that things end, isn't why we suffer, which brings us to number two. The second noble truth is that suffering is caused by attachment, or the desire for something. So because life is short, because everybody dies, everything has some form of entropy, some containment in its life force and in its continuancy, the attachment to life makes the life itself suffering if one looks at one's impending doom. That can ruin one's mindset. As just an example. But attachment to chocolate, attachment to sugar, attachment to fat, attachment to cigarettes, attachment to narcotics, attachment to something else, attachment to anger, because that's how we deal with our situations, because that's how we deal with a bout with somebody, is that we get angry and we flip out. You know, these are attachments to situations and reactions. And these attachments cause suffering. But the Buddha would say that any attachment causes suffering. So I'm happy right now. I feel okay right now. I feel good right now. I want this to go on forever. That's an attachment. Because just like our lives, our feelings and our thoughts are just as impermanent as our short lives. So, if we attach ourselves to our happiness, we are setting up a line of suffering when we lose it. Or, you know, we're suffering. We want something better to happen. That can feel good to get out of suffering. But then there's that topsy-turvy. We're going to go back down again eventually. There's always going to be something that shows up. And that's the crux, that life has suffering. That suffering is caused by our attachments to things in life. Noble truth number three. We can rid ourselves of attachment. We can soothe suffering, and by soothing our suffering, we can soothe the world's suffering. If we can be examples of non-attachment, non-ado, to be able to rid ourselves of attachment is truth number four. It's called the Eightfold Path, which is, I'm going to say it slowly and I'm going to go through each one by one. Right understanding, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Now, I'm no Buddhist expert, and I'm still a philosophical infant, and I'm still on the age range. I'm still a baby. I'm still very young. So I'm just going to give my opinion on what these words mean, and this is tongue-in-cheek especially, and you take it what you will. I hope it helps. So right understanding means that when we approach a situation, being able to understand it, and that takes practice, and it takes constant awareness, which is another one, mindfulness, right? Mindfulness is holding, maintaining a mindful attitude. So if we're practicing our mindfulness when we enter a situation, hopefully we're going to perceive well, and that would be the right understanding portion of this. Right thought. It's not all about what you say. It's not all about what you do. We all have ugly thoughts, but we can recognize it. And we don't have to glorify the ugly thoughts we have. So through practice, again, we can police in a negative aspect, or we can be in good terms. I keep wanting to think be a good father to your subconscious, but, you know, be a good leader to your thoughts, and to be like, hey man, I don't like what I'm thinking right now. That's not good. I want to change this, and I want to do something a little bit differently. Right speech, just like thought, but it's on the outside. It's what we tell people. You know, a big thing that I deal with a lot is that I get excited and I want to talk out, and I interrupt people a lot. And a lot of times I'll be in my kitchen and I'll have a compulsion to tell somebody something I heard or something I'm interested in or something I'm working on. And I'll literally just, like, in a 30-minute span, I'll walk out 6 times until I can see they're not doing something or they're alone. And then I'll, like, ambush them. And then I'll just tell them the story. And then before they'll even say anything, I'll walk away, because the only thing I wanted to do was use them as a body to hear my bullshit. So that's not a good use of speech, right? Right speech is speaking on purpose. Everything that would come out of your mouth would be pertinent and hopefully helpful or effective in doing something good for the people around you in your situation. So not just bragging, not just gossiping, not just bullshitting, not just showing off, you know, not being a smart mouth. Something I do a lot, you know. Right action is the things we do with our body. You know, it's how we treat people. It's the things that we do, having good duty in our work, I would say. Right livelihood is living well, eating well, sleeping well, taking care of our bodies. Yet again, I think it's contagious. If we take care of ourselves, it flakes off on other people. Right effort. What are our intentions? What do we do? What are we putting forth into the world? What are we making? What are we creating? How are we loving? Are we loving ourselves? If we love ourselves, that's where the contagion of love starts with. And even speaking about love, you know, do you consider love to be a verb or a noun? I love you. Is that something I'm giving you? I think it is. But is it something I took from outside and I picked off of a tree and then handed to you? No. I am love. Love is inside my being. It's in my core. And I nurture it so that I can give it to other people. But it's like giving a piece of myself. But it's not just myself. It's part of everybody. Because love is part of the glue that makes us human. And I would even hazard to say that every other creature, even a housefly, has degrees of love. You know, watching that ant from A Bug's Life, episode single digit something. You know, in A Bug's Life, I mentioned watching this ant hustle this huge fucking just massive earthworm trying to get it home, and I watched it for 30 minutes, and I knew that it was probably spent all day long just getting that thing back to its crib, just trying to get it to its queen, or to its, I personally believe it was trying to get it to its hive, not just the queen, you know. But love is something we embody and is something that we nurture so that we can give it to others. That's another one of my personal beliefs. And right concentration, which means, I guess I have to think more about what the distinction is between mindfulness and concentration, because I would consider mindfulness being maybe concentration is being focused on the things that are happening and being on, having your lights on, being pointed towards the things. And mindfulness is being present within the mind and being capable of taking things in and feeling. So concentration is more of the open doors and outward projection of focus, whereas mindfulness is the reciprocity, the ability to receive, you know, the soft, ooey-gooey plastic, maybe. So these are my thoughts. These are going to change. I'll probably have more talks about the noble truths again in the future when I understand them better. And hopefully you'll make up your own ideas. Please look it up. Watch a YouTube video. Just see what people have talked about. Four short lines just to consider, to think about how they could affect your life and how you could play. How you could play your own games. Either way, I've had a lot of fun tonight. I try to take it a little bit off rails. I've been doing heavy note-taking my last two episodes because they were really important to me. So this was more just right off the top of my head. And I had a lot more fun with it. It was a lot less heavy. So tonight's episode is brought to you by your sponsor. You can find your sponsor. Its name is... Sorry, I'm trying to build up tension here. I'm probably just pissing people off. Anyways, your sponsor tonight is Curiosity. Curiosity can be found even in an infant. You were born with it. Everybody has it. You can stuff your briefcase with it. You can stoke it with gasoline like a fire. Curiosity is like a spark, like electricity. You can thank your local Curiosity company by... I don't know where I was going with this. But anyways, yep. Today's episode, sponsored by Curiosity. Please be curious. Please just go find something interested in and tell me about it. Please. Please teach me something. Please educate me. I think it would be fascinating just to have a bunch of curious cats all going out and getting themselves killed. I'm just kidding. Curiosity might have killed the cat, but we are very, very, very cautious felines around here. And even though we're very, very curious, I'm not that worried about any of us. So thank you again. Appreciate you. You are loved. You are important. You have purpose. And I'm just so grateful to have your attention and your ears tonight. Thank you so much. Get some rest. Go eat something really healthy. Go tell somebody you love them. I'll talk to you next week.